Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the two latest stories of evidence emerging revealing possible collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia, with McClatchy reporting that cell signals off a cell tower in Prague placed the mobile phone of Trump's fixer, Michael Cohen, near Prague in late August, early September of 2016. The other story from an investigation by Time reveals that Viktor Boyarkin, a former military intelligence officer working for the Russian oligarch Oleg Deripaska, pressured Trump's former campaign manager Paul Manafort over debts he owed, but when approached by Robert Mueller's investigators, told the special counsel's team to go dig a ditch. Scott Horton, a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor to Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security, joins us to discuss the disconnect between Cohen denying that he went to Prague on Trump's behalf to meet with Russians at the height of the presidential campaign, as alleged in the Steele dossier, and the fact that Cohen spent 70 hours providing evidence to Mueller and recently tweeted that Mueller knows all. We will also look into the likelihood that Deripaska, a Russian oligarch close to Putin, got Manafort hooked on his money. Then, after Manafort had squandered $20 million of it on luxury items, Deripaska had Boyarkin lean on the greedy American for access and favors once Manafort had become Trump's campaign manager. Then we'll look further into the intelligence aspects of the cell phone evidence of Cohen's possible presence in the Czech Republic, indicating that yet more of the Steele dossier could be verified, and speak with a former CIA operations officer, Robert Baer, who was hired by the UN tribunal investigating the assassination of Lebanon's president and used cell phone metadata to track down the Hezbollah assassins operating with Iran. We will look into whether the Russians abandoned tradecraft in conspiring with amateurs from the Trump campaign because Putin likes to have it both ways, as he did with the assassinations of Russian dissidents in the UK. He has plausible deniability while at the same time signaling he approves of what happened. Then, having already politicized the judiciary, we'll examine Trump's latest efforts to politicize one of the few American institutions left that tries to stay above and away from politics, the U.S. military. Patrick Mandaka, an instructor at the John Jay School of Criminal Justice at the City University of New York, who served in the U.S. Army in Baghdad, Iraq in 2003, joins us to discuss his article at CNN, "Trump is a Fairweather Friend to the Troops." We'll assess whether interning a Christmas visit to troops in Iraq and Germany into campaign rallies, at which Trump lied about giving the men and women in uniform a big pay raise, the commander-in-chief crossed a red line. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Scott Horton, a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He serves on the American branch of the International Law Association and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Horton.
Great to be with you, Ian.
Well, thank you, Scott. And I've spoken with Peter Stone, who wrote the piece for McClatchy, and unfortunately, at the last minute, he wasn't able to join us today. What do you make of it? Because there's some doubts about whether this is really pinned down, and maybe it's sort of preempting some of what Mueller is trying to reveal. I mean, I guess the disconnect that I'm referred to in the opening, Scott, is that after having spent 70 hours debriefing, being questioned by Mueller, Michael Cohen still denies the Trump that he visited Prague in late August, early September of 2016, just at the height of the campaign. But at the same time, he spent so much time with him, and then he tweeted out recently that Mueller knows all. Could he be denying that he did this or that he was in Prague as a way to sort of not preempt the Mueller report? Because if Cohen were to say to the press, yeah, I was in Prague, then that would blow the whole Trump story wide open. There'd be blood in the water, and the collusion that Trump keeps denying would be front and center.
Well, I agree. I mean, I think this whole story is absolutely puzzling. And, of course, we have a lot of shots being fired now at the McClatchy people. I think I've seen an article recently in the Daily Beast saying they're either the new Woodward and Bernstein or they're more like Judy Miller. And to be clear, I don't think either of those is true. I mean, I think the whole story may actually wind up being much less than meets the eye. And I think we have to keep in mind that nowhere are they providing any information about the content of any discussions he may have had, which would be critical. We also have to keep in mind that the standards of proof and evidence that are used for intelligence operations of the sort that Christopher Steele was running and are used in a criminal justice inquiry, what Bob Mueller is doing, are really very, very different. So Mueller, if he is trying to make out a case of collusion, it's really more criminal conspiracy or joint criminal enterprise he's dealing with. He wouldn't make that case on the basis of one single incident in one place. That would be done on the basis of conduct over a prolonged period of time. So this, might be an interesting little piece in the whole story, but I'm almost sure is not going to be the centerpiece of the whole story. There would be much, much more. So if there was money that passed, he would be focusing on the movement of money, for instance. And in this case, one of the most puzzling things is that Mueller has an arrangement with Michael Cohen. He's certainly far from being a conventional cooperating witness. But normally, in any such arrangement, there is a firm understanding. And in fact, it is sort of a boilerplate part of any cooperating witness agreement that he will not speak to the press. He will be quiet. He will shut up about what he has said and what he's done with Mueller. So he's not following those rules, and that is very, very odd. So what I would have expected him to do is be quiet. And the fact that he's spoken and said what he said just creates more questions in my mind. And one of them is whether he's not just trying to throw people off the trail of what's going on. And I think it may very well be the case that Mueller – I think it is almost certainly the case that Mueller – has assembled evidence and has a case to present against Trump based on what is commonly called collusion. But I think we really don't know the details of it. We have very, very little evidence of that. And I think he's trying to tell us that perhaps that Prague is not a part of it, or perhaps Prague is a centerpiece in it. Who knows?
Well, let's go to August of 2016. What we know is that late August, the last few days of August, Cohen was out here in Los Angeles with his son, and he set him up with a meeting at USC to get his kid into USC. And then there's like 48 hours that aren't accounted for. It's possible that he could have flown by private jet from here to Munich, I think it was, where he might well have touched down and then have been driven across the border into the Czech Republic, and then had his meeting with the Russians. I mean, the Steele dossier actually names a fairly senior Russian official that he's alleged to have met with and paid off of the Russian hackers did the hacking into the DNC and into Podesta. But preceding that, there was a meeting in the Hamptons, which included Dmitry Rybolovkov. How do you pronounce his name?
Rybolovkov.
Yes, Rybolovkov.
The so-called potassium king.
The potassium king, right. The potash king, right. He met with both Michael Cohen, Ivanka, and Kushner, and possibly Manafort in the Hamptons. So was that meeting the source on that is Glenn Simpson from Fuge and GPS, the people who paid for the Steele dossier. This comes from his testimony to the House. he basically, Simpson was trying to get the House off the dime to do some serious investigations and told them to look into this meeting. What do you know about that meeting in the Hamptons?
Well, it seems very clear that Lubyov is a key figure in all of this, and his aircraft is making trips back and forth across the ocean during this time and seems to have been put at the disposal of Trump and the Trump campaign. Certainly, it's showing up the same time Trump does at Trump rallies, and it's hard to understand why a Russian potash magnate would be doing that. And he's appearing at Trump events. And, of course, he's the man who plopped down close to $100 million to Trump for a piece of property he never used or did anything with when Trump badly needed cash. So this is definitely one of the key connections between the Kremlin and Trump. And he seems to be very active in the campaign, and he seems to be active in dealings with Cohen. So I think I think Simpson's indication was right. This is something that really merits being followed up with. And, you know, I'm relatively certain that Mueller has followed up with that. I think he's followed up with things like the movement of the jet and the payment of cash. Lubyov himself has gotten into big criminal justice trouble for tax evasion in Monaco in France right now, in connection with a very famous Leonardo da Vinci painting. So he's definitely under the loop in many different jurisdictions, and I think those prosecutors are all cooperating with Mueller and sharing notes, including electronic media they seized from him. But again, we know from the outside that a lot of investigations going on, that questions are being asked, depositions are being taken, documents have been seized. We know that a lot of attention has been focused on this, but we don't know what conclusions have been drawn.
And again, I'm speaking with Scott Horton, who's a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He serves on the American branch of the International Law Association and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. So let's turn to the Time magazine investigation by Simon Schuster, who's been there Russian correspondent for some time. You know this character, don't you, Scott? Viktor Boyakin?
I do, yes. He has been for many years one of Oleg Deripaska's right hands, and he is he's an intelligence community officer. He's a lieutenant colonel of the Military Intelligence Service, GRU. Or he says, of course, a former lieutenant colonel of the military. But, you know, I don't really believe so much in the former part of it.
Well, neither does Putin, by the way. He once said that. There's no such thing as a former spy.
These people maintain relations and continue to do work, and this provides his work with Rusal, and Deripaska gives him a cover for doing work. I've had dealings with him in Africa where he's represented Deripaska's operations for some time. And even there, I think what he's doing all the time is principally intelligence gathering operations. Pretty obviously that's the case. And in this case, he's one of two GRU officers who are seen as having fairly frequent contacts with Paul Manafort. The other one is a figure already indicted, Konstantin Kalimnik, also a GRU officer, who worked directly with Manafort, and we know also constituted sort of a bridge or connection between Manafort and Oleg Deripaska. But Boyarkin, is a senior figure in Deripaska's commercial operations as well. And, of course, the reports here, the Time magazine piece has a number of really fascinating elements to it. I mean, the most important by far is he has Boyarkin pressing Manafort to sign up with the Trump operation, to become active as the campaign manager for Trump. And he's also trying to enlist Manafort in operations that Deripaska is running, which are concurrent with operations of the Russian intelligence services, particularly in the Republic of Montenegro. Now, around this time, Montenegro's prime minister had announced that he was going to join NATO, and he was feverishly doing this, and this had produced the real ire of Putin, who tried to destabilize the government in Montenegro and tried to cut it off from the West any way he could. And then ultimately...
And there was an assassination attempt, was there not?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And the GRU, military intelligence, was involved in that assassination attempt. And as all this was going on, Manafort was involved in these destabilization operations and then lobbying. And Manafort also involved a number of other Republican campaign lobbyists in the operation. And I'll note one thing that's very, very strange is that all of these operations are going on in Montenegro, an obscure congressman from California is regularly traveling out to Montenegro at least two times without checking in with the U.S. Embassy. And that's as these operations are happening. And that fellow's name is Devin Nunes, the man who went on to be the chair of the Intelligence Committee, in fact. So, you know, he's never explained what he was doing in Montenegro. And, of course, now with the Time story, we see this big operation being set up that Manafort is deeply involved in. So it seems Nunes had a lot that he didn't want discovered.
Well, hopefully on Thursday when the Democrats take over with Adam Schiff, I know he's got a lot on his plate. Maybe he can look into that. But let's talk a little bit about Deripaska, because he's back in the news for some reason or other. The Trump administration is exempting him from sanctions. They're removing sanctions that he had that have been placed on him. What's going on there? I mean, and Deripaska, I always thought that what happened with Manafort was they knew that this guy was greedy, Manafort. The Russian, if you see Deripaska as a cutout for Putin, he got Manafort hooked on money, and then Manafort squandered it all on luxury goods, at least $20 million of Deripaska's money that was supposed to be invested by Manafort went missing. And then when he either encouraged him to get the job through the guy that you know, Bayarkin, or he got the job as the campaign manager for no salary, and then suddenly all was forgiven, and Deripaska was offered special private briefings, and they took out of the Republican platform any mention of helping Ukraine resist Russia. So it seems to me that's an old isn't that an old mob MO, Scott? You get somebody hooked on money, then you own them?
Well, I think it is. I mean, a mob, it's not just mob, it's also a classic modus operandi of the Russian intelligence services. In fact, you know, some of the guidebooks that were smuggled out and published at Cambridge University, you know, at the very end of the Cold War, and shortly after the collapse of the Soviet Union, like the Kryuchkov files, showed the methods that they would use, and that they would always be a combination of negative and positive incentives. And the positive incentives would always include money. So you give people money, you make them dependent on your money, but you build up debt so they owe you. And then that is used as sort of a hammer. You call in that debt. That places them under tremendous pressure to perform for you in certain ways. So that is a classic modus operandi, both of organized crime and of intelligence services, not just Russian, others too.
Well, just in closing, Scott, let's look ahead at 2019. Obviously, the Mueller inquiry dominated 2018, and it's likely to be even more front and center, particularly. I mean, the indications are that something's going to be dropped relatively soon. Some people have said February. Meanwhile, of course, you've got this Deputy Attorney General doing everything he can to sabotage it from the inside. And I think it's pretty clear that Trump is behaving more and more like a trapped animal, lashing out. I don't know what's going on, frankly. I mean, you know, my conspiratorial mind tells me that, you know, that if Putin owns Trump, Putin probably realizes Trump doesn't have much shelf life left, so he's getting as many favors out of his Manchurian candidate as he can. He's got the enormous gift of the U.S. handing over Syria to Putin. But the other gift that could be the real gift that to Putin would be pulling out of NATO. And Trump has hinted that he wants to do that as recently as his as his bizarre speech to the troops in Iraq.
Well, I think you're right. I mean, it does seem to be some basis for all those concerns. And with respect to Mueller's timeline, I mean, one would normally think this is the sort of investigation that would take many, many years to complete. But notwithstanding that, of course, NBC has gone very heavily with a report that his report will be submitted by the end of February. And I talked to some NBC reporters about that, trying to understand what their sources were. Their sources were inside the Justice Department, particularly inside the office of the Deputy Attorney General. So it was around Rosenberg.
Rosenstein.
And I think those are good sources, but I also think, and I think that means that something is going to be in, but I find it just impossible to believe that the entire investigation could be wound up on this timeline. That's not possible. But I think we're probably going to see some real explosions occur before the end of February. So that's 2 months out now.
Well, Scott Horton, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Great pleasure.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Scott Horton, who's a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He serves on the American branch of the International Law Association and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking in further into the intelligence aspect of this cell phone evidence of Cohen's possible presence in the Czech Republic.
From Russia with love, I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you. I've traveled the world.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Robert Baer, one of the most accomplished agents in CIA history and the winner of the Career Intelligence Medal. He's the author of 4 New York Times bestsellers, including See No Evil and Sleeping with the Devil, How Washington Sold Our Soul for Saudi Crude. He's considered one of the world's foremost authorities on the Middle East and is the current National Security Affairs Analyst for CNN, and his latest book is The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassinations. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Baer.
Thanks, Ian.
And since you were hired by the United Nations Tribunal investigating the assassination of Lebanon's president, and I take it that you used cell phone metadata to track down the assassins, how does that relate to this story that's coming out of McClatchy that it looks like they've got some cell phone metadata from the Czech Republic that indicates that Michael Cohen's cell phone, I believe it was one of the ones that the FBI grabbed in their raid, was pinging off a cell tower. I don't know how they got hold of that metadata. I don't know whether the intelligence services do it legally or hack into it. I don't know how that happens. But let's start with the broader question. What do you make of the McClatchy story? Because if it does place Cohen there in the Czech Republic before the elections, meeting with Russians, as is in the Steele dossier, it's incredibly explosive.
Well, it could be explosive in two ways. One is that Cohen went there, if in fact he did, to meet with the Russians to discuss the elections. Or number two is Cohen. He's been involved in a lot of illegal activities with his family, with Russian mobsters. This could have been something personal. And, you know, did he sort this out with Cohen? But on metadata like this, it's easily available. It can be obtained privately if you have the cell phone number. You can find out where it pinged. It'd be very easy to go to the Czech Republic, get this confirmed. And let's not forget that, you know, Mohammed Atta, the mastermind of 9/11, supposedly went to Prague, and that turned out to be a nonsense story. So with this McClatchy report, we're going to have to see a lot more substance before anybody can believe it. But right now, it's a big question mark for me. But once you do have that data, you're absolutely right. It's explosive. It's forensics, and you can get indictments on it and break open cases.
Well, what about though the private jet aspect of this story? Because we know that Cohen was in Los Angeles at the end of August with his son, getting him into USC, and this about 48 hours. There, the last days of August, first days of September in 2016, at the height of the presidential campaign, that are unaccounted for. Could you take a private jet from L.A. to Munich, drive into the Czech Republic, meet with the Russians, and get back? And what would happen? How would you avoid customs and immigration?
Well, you mostly can't. I mean, look at the Central Intelligence Agency tried to do this with renditions, moving planes, people around, and they were all exposed. So I really doubt that Michael Cohen could, trick the system like this. I just think there would be some record of a private jet with his departure that could pinpoint. In fact, he went to Prague. His statement that he never visited Prague, did he go to Czechoslovakia, Czech Republic and get near Prague and got a ping off a cell phone? There's all sorts of unanswered questions. And really what we would need to know is the sources of the McClatchy report. So, and I've heard this Prague thing, that they were pinging off the cell phones for almost the last year, but nobody has proved evidence, given me evidence, and that there's some evidence apparently out there that he left his hotel, stayed checked in, but left the hotel for 2 days. But, the rest of it, again, so much wishful thinking in this that we're going to get a smoking gun on Trump that it misleads a lot of us. But I think that, in fact, if we go back to Scott's talk, Russian intelligence has been around Donald Trump going back to 1986. That's just a fact. They've looked at him as a useful idiot, what they call in their terms a trusted contact, which they never expose themselves as KGB or representing the Russian government, just throw a lot of money around. If he's willing to take a Soviet line and later a Russian line, that was fine with them. What interests me in this whole story is we keep on hearing names of staff Russian intelligence officers that are being introduced into this circle. And it looks to me as if once the Russians understood that Trump was a serious political player and had a long-term value, then they wanted to get in direct contact with him. And we saw this with Jared Kushner bringing up a back channel to the Russians. We saw in that June meeting in Trump Tower, there was a Russian intelligence officer at that. It never went anywhere. And we also see lots of staff officers, Russian intelligence officers, around Manafort. So I think what happened in this, once this campaign started to take off, that the Russians were playing catch-up ball and say, hey, our man, a guy we know very well, that will take our line and all sorts of things. We have to pin this down. And that's what they really wanted to do. They were a bit late, but it doesn't take away from the bottom line that Trump has been floated by Russia as well as other criminal money going back to the 80s. They bailed him out. It's fact.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Baer, one of the most accomplished agents in CIA history and the winner of the Korea Intelligence Medal. He's the author of four New York Times bestsellers, including See No Evil and Sleeping with the Devil, Washington Sold Our Soul for Saudi Crude. And he's considered one of the world's foremost authorities on the Middle East and is currently the National Security Affairs Analyst for CNN. And his latest book is The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassinations. Well, one of the aspects of this McClatchy story, if it turns out to be true, about Cohen's phone pinging off a cell tower in Prague, is that it does buttress more of the Steele dossier, and so far the Steele dossier has proven to be correct, and it's being gradually corroborated. But the Steele dossier names Konstantin Gusachev, a longtime member of the Russian Senate, a chairman of the Russian Federation's Council of Foreign Affairs Committee, that he didn't necessarily attend the gathering in Prague, but he facilitated it. So that gets to the kind of amateurism. Why would professional Russian intelligence operatives work with such amateurs as the Trump people? Because, as I mentioned in the opening, my sense is that Putin likes to have it both ways, like with the people that he assassinated in the UK. He denies that he had his fingerprints on it, but he signals to that he approves of what was done.
Well, you have to look at who Putin is. He runs the country, and he runs the intelligence services. And he was never properly an intelligence officer. When he was assigned to Dresden, he worked with Stasi, running cover companies in West Germany. He was essentially money laundering for Stasi and the KGB. He goes to St. Petersburg and hooks up with the mafia up there. And that's basically how he wedges his way into power with criminal organizations. So as far as running, traditional intelligence operation of recruiting, paying, and controlling assets, he doesn't know anything about it. KGB officers that I know look down on him. They call him a provincial who doesn't know what he's doing. So what he's done is, he's created this hybrid, which is inserting Russian KGB officers, GRU, into business enterprises and letting them not only watch those enterprises and the oligarchs that run them, but also go out and troll for sources. And it's always going to be very sloppy because they do not have encrypted communications. They're on open cell phones. They're wheeling, dealing, spending money, giving $20 million to Manafort. No intelligence service in the world except Russia's works this way. So when we keep on catching them, we're sort of dumbfounded because this is not the KGB we used to know during the Cold War at all. I mean, that whole moronic assassination attempt in Salisbury is just incredible. I mean, everybody in the world knows about the Iron Ring in London, about the cameras and sending these two guys up there. And it's the whole country. It's such a loose structure that you have a difficult time, calling it an intelligence agency. So they do get caught. But on the other hand, they have so much loose money that they can get to people that other intelligence agencies can't, like Donald Trump. Trust me, the CIA could never run a similar operation against a Russian oligarch where, you go in and you say, all right, spend $20 or $30 million for a yacht and girls and the rest of it. None of them can do that. So there's the upsides and the downsides to Russian intelligence, and we're seeing this in the whole Trump thing. We would like to pin it down that he is a Manchurian candidate. He may be, deeply under their control, but it's not the kind of control that an intelligence officer, that's preferable at all.
Because that's what the former DNI Clapper said, that Putin is Trump's case officer. But is there a bigger problem here? In other words, we've never seen in geopolitics before the fusion of organized crime and national security, nuclear weapons and the mafia, and that in the Soviet days, the KGB had ideology. The whole system had ideology. It may have been bogus, but it nevertheless had ideology until the glue simply couldn't stick anymore and it fell apart. But nowadays, there doesn't seem to be any ideology. It seems to be complete criminality. So is that what's happened to the Russian intelligence services? They've essentially been criminalized?
The Russian intelligence has been totally criminalized. Russia itself is a criminal enterprise. And it is hooked up with an American outer borough grifter who badly in need of money and is under an enormous amount of financial pressure as well as political pressure. And there's no wiggle room for him. I don't know if he's compos mentis or not, but there's no wiggle room for him, and the Russians have him. And, you know, did he give Syria away because of Putin? I can't explain it other than that.
Right. Well, we don't know what went on in that meeting that they had in Helsinki. That in itself is an absolute crime. And I don't know why people aren't demanding. Every time world leaders and American presidents meet, there's a printout, there's notes taken. There's no such thing in that meeting. So, you know, that in itself.
And it's never happened before. Those sort of meetings with heads of state are documented, whether they're with ambassadors or the president. They're always documented to see what promises were made on both sides. It's never happened before. Just the optics of this makes you wonder how deeply Trump is into the Russians. I mean, the more he attacks NATO, the more he gives up the most successful counterinsurgency we've run in decades for no reason at all. What can I tell you? This is not good.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes then, Robert, since we're reaching the end of 2018, I talked a minute ago with Scott Horton about the Mueller, and apparently NBC is saying that sometime in February the report, or at least a part of the report, will come out, notwithstanding the fact that Trump's put his guy in there, Whitaker, to stymie things. What do you think is going to happen here? I mean, do you think Trump can last? I made the speculation that maybe Putin's figured out that Trump's shelf life is he's running out of room and running out of rope here. How do you see this? On Thursday, the House changes hands. But one of the things that Scott said that was interesting was that it was Devin Nunes that kept visiting Montenegro at the time when the Russians were, and Deripaska, working presumably for Putin, was trying to influence the government, if you will.
Well, the fact that the right, the American right, has gravitated toward Moscow is one of the biggest changes I've seen in my life, including the end of the Cold War. Never seen anything like it, that a part of the American body politic is supporting, like I said, a criminal enterprise like Putin, somebody clearly hostile to our interests, and that they can get away with it. This is a sort of a crumbling of foundations that I never thought would come to this country, and it's so clear-cut. So it's basically, I think we're going to move into impeachment proceedings as more and more comes out, and it's going to be up to the Senate. And whether the Republicans think now's the time to cut their losses or later, or maybe get away with it.
Well, it is reaching a kind of crisis level, is it not? Is it possible that under all of this pressure, Trump could crack up?
That I can't answer.
Right.
But if he keeps the federal government closed for the next 6 months, you're going to see what a real crisis looks like.
Right. Well, that's what's extraordinary is that from the Democrats' point of view, starting on Thursday, they don't have anybody to talk to. There's nobody on the Republican side that can deliver anything coherent. And if you negotiate with this guy, it doesn't matter. He's likely to change his mind the second after you think you got to deal with him.
You got to impeach him. There's no choice. You got to rip the Band-Aid off.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Robert Baer.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Robert Baer, one of the most accomplished agents in CIA history and the winner of the Career Intelligence Medal. He's the author of 4 New York Times bestsellers, including See No Evil and Sleeping with the Devil, Our Washington Soul, Our Soul for Saudi Crude. And he's considered one of the world's foremost authorities on the Middle East and is the current National Security Affairs Analyst for CNN. And his latest book is The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassinations. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into how the military have responded to Trump's efforts to politicize the U.S. military. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Patrick Mundaka, who is an instructor at the John Jay School of Criminal Justice at the City University of New York. In 2003, he served in the U.S. Army in Baghdad, Iraq, and he has an op-ed at CNN, "Trump is a fair-weather friend to the troops." Welcome to Background Briefing, Patrick Mundaka.
Thank you.
So, Patrick, I obviously want to talk to you about your article about Trump's visit to both the troops in Iraq and Germany over the Christmas vacation in a surprise trip, which many people were grateful that the president took. But on the other hand, a lot of criticism resulted from his very, very partisan speeches that he made, particularly to the troops in Iraq and also to the troops in Germany. But today on the ABC program this week, General Stanley McChrystal was asked about what he thought about Trump, and he basically said that Trump is immoral and doesn't tell the truth. And just to quote McChrystal, "If we want to be governed by someone we wouldn't do a business deal with because their background is so shady, if we're willing to do that, then that's in conflict with who I think we are. And so I think it's necessary at those times to take a stand." What kind of influence does McChrystal have over the troops, not to mention what kind of influence Mattis has over the troops since he's been treated so poorly?
Well, I think both McChrystal and both Mattis were these revered, respected generals who had the full support of the troops throughout the different branches. And when you see leaders like these speaking out or going so far as to resign their posts from the Secretary of Defense, basically on principle, because, you know, General Mattis was not supportive of abandoning the Kurds, basically, to probably their annihilation by the Turks. I think the troops are listening. I think the service members are watching, and they see this, and it's something that I don't believe that they will ignore forever. I believe that, like McChrystal, there is a point where you have to speak truth to power, and whether the service members will begin speaking out more vocally, such as like the generals, I think it's yet to be seen.
So, Patrick, what was your sense then, as somebody that served in Iraq, of what the president said? Because it was pretty manifestly clear that it was very political. He attacked Nancy Pelosi. He basically kept saying how much support he was getting from the crowd without the camera showing you the crowd. And then he was also basically saying how many people had red hats, the Make America Great Again hats, which we again weren't able to see. And one of the things about Trump with his loose association with the truth is that he's quite skillful in terms of propaganda. And he's enabled, of course. He's got his own Pravda, if you will, with Fox News. So that, to me, I found the most disturbing, was that he was basically saying, this crowd adores me and they agree with me. And was that the case, do you think?
I don't believe so. And I you know, haven't quite analyzed it in depth, but as far as I understand, as having served in the military, there wouldn't be an abundance of red Make America Great Again hats floating around any particular unit. So in terms of like a propaganda or a staged political stunt or dog and pony show, as we would call it in the military, I would be more inclined to believe that those hats were passed out by Trump's people prior to the coverage that was given, a press release.
Well, there is some back and forth, and of course the White House denies that and accuses CNN of being unpatriotic by even suggesting that the Trump campaign people circulated those hats. But there must still, I mean, I assume there's some support for Trump, but isn't the whole point in the military not to display in fact, as far as I know, there's a directive from the Department of Defense that prohibits active duty personnel from engaging in partisan political activities. And I'll just read you a little bit of the directive. All military personnel should avoid the inference that their political activities imply or appear to imply Department of Defense sponsorship, approval, or endorsement of a political candidate, campaign, or cause. That's pretty unambiguous.
Yeah, that's pretty clear. And soldiers would be generally considered to be not political by means of their occupation, which is to, in the end, defend the Constitution, which is not a political choice.
And that's the oath that they swear, right?
Yes.
So given that there is some influence over the military in terms of, well, when you were in Iraq, were there any manifestations of political activity, political support or for or against the war?
No, I would say because we were generally too focused on our duties of patrolling and maintaining law and order, we really weren't concerned with what was happening back in the political arena. And if any politicians had come to visit, they were, you know, so high above our level, we wouldn't have seen them anyway, being embedded within tanker divisions out in the city. We saw no such, like, higher-level political representatives. But then again, you know, none of us sought to pack any campaign hats or pins or flags. It just wasn't something that was in our mindset. And if it, you know, I imagine if somebody was waving around some type of political advertisement, one of our platoon leaders would have quickly squashed it.
And again, I'm speaking with Patrick Mundaka, who is a instructor at John Jay School of Criminal Justice at the City University of New York. In 2003, he served in the U.S. Army in Baghdad, Iraq, and he has an op-ed at CNN, "Trump is a fair-weather friend to the troops." So given that Trump did politicize the visit to the troops in both Germany and Iraq, and we mentioned earlier some of the blowback from General McChrystal and others who've been critical, what do you make of the fact that we no longer have a military general with a lot of respect and experience, as Mattis brings to the table, or brought to the table? And earlier than that, of course, there was another general who was the National Security Advisor, and he got fired because he spoke truth to power and apparently it made Trump uncomfortable, General McMaster, and then the other generals leaving as well. And there's been, obviously there was some criticism of having too many generals in there, but now we're in the paradoxical position where we basically want some adults in the room. So what do you make of the replacement for General Mattis being essentially an exemplar of the military-industrial complex, an executive from Boeing?
I would certainly have to assume that any executive from a corporate environment that's just been essentially inserted into the high offices of government to take over one of the most powerful departments within the United States government, being simply a Boeing executive is not going to inspire much confidence within the vast majority of the service members from all different services. I fear for the future of the Defense Department at the moment, as many do.
Indeed, my old friend, the late Colonel David Hackworth, who was America's most decorated living soldier, he used to talk about the boys versus the toys, that, you know, do they take care of the boys or they take care of the toys? Where does the money go? And, of course, in the speech that Trump made in Iraq, he said that he'd given them the troops a 10% pay raise, which is completely untrue.
Which was a lie.
Right, but is there any blowback? I mean, are Stars and Stripes and others pointing out that this was a lie? I mean, in case somebody missed it, I imagine troops know that they've been getting a steady pay raise. In fact, the biggest one was in 2012.
Yeah, I don't think, and that's one of the reasons why the Kipling poem kind of struck home to me, was that the whole idea that, you know, Tommy sees Tommy Atkins, and, you know, and for us it was the Doughboys and whatever else you want to name the common soldier. But the common soldier is not just the common soldier. The common soldier is the backbone of the military. and they are not just pieces to be moved about someone's political agenda. I think that when it comes down to it, and my faith and my belief is that the core of the military is that which is represented by Tommy and Kipling's poem, and the core soldiers, the common soldiers, those are the ones who in the end follow leadership like Mattis, like McChrystal. They being trotted out for a photo op and handed out some rad hats. And soldiers, I was one. Soldiers are going to go to, you know, an event and see the president or see whoever else is there to entertain them for the brief moment that they're there, because soldiers are inherently bored. War is boring, it's terrifying, but mostly there's a lot of sitting around, and if somebody wants, you know, trot you out for a photo op, you trot you out for a photo op, because generally, I mean, I'm going to bet that those soldiers that were there didn't have a choice. And surely some of them found it great and entertaining. And a break in the boredom, which they're surely experiencing from day to day.
And the Kipling poem that you talk about, the poem Tommy, just to quote a little bit of it, but it's savior of his country when the guns begin to shoot. And it's Tommy this and Tommy that and anything you please. And Tommy ain't a bloomin' fool. You bet that Tommy sees. So I think that makes your point, Patrick. But just in the last couple of minutes, what do you make of the deployment of the soldiers on the southern border over Christmas? And it's worth noting that the president is now threatening to seal the southern border, and I assume that would have to be done with military assets. So remember, this was at the height of the campaign before the midterms, and this caravan from Central America was being ginned up as a major threat. Trump said that there were Middle Easterners amongst the Central Americans, mostly poor people, escaping violence in these failed states, effectively, in Central America. And the troops were sent down there over the Christmas holidays, and they're still sitting down there, and frankly, they were used as political props. At least that's the way most people saw it. How did you see it?
I saw it similarly, and you know, I saw them as pawns that are placed at the whim of this particularly petulant president who threw essentially temper tantrums when he didn't get his way. Said, well, I can do what I want. I can move these troops down to the border and I'll leave them there. And what are they doing down there? Unarmed, camped out, watching, bored. And that is not a good use of our nation's military and essentially the best of our populace. Like, these are citizens who volunteered with the understanding that their lives, if necessary, would be expended for a good cause, for the good cause of the nation's interest, not for a president who is trying to drum up support for midterm elections or to, because he's lashing out at his political foes. I think it's disgraceful.
Well, just in closing, though, my understanding is that he is the commander-in-chief, and basically he can say anything, and the troops have to salute and do it. For example, he's against the advice of Mattis, his own Secretary of State, his own National Security Advisor, without consulting his allies. Everybody's appalled at they're pulling 2,000 troops out of Syria, who were the cork in the bottle there, holding at bay the Turks, the Assad regime, Russia, and Iran, and for a very small investment, they had a lot of influence. And Trump's, of course, went and visited the troops in Iraq. He has no problem with 7,000 troops in Iraq, but for some reason or other, he has a problem with 2,000 who are doing an extraordinary job, and they haven't had one casualty. And they were attacked by a group of Russian mercenaries who they just absolutely creamed. So it's just crazy, and there's a possibility that what Trump was hinting at in his speech in Iraq when he talked about us not being suckers anymore, he was returning to his mantra about NATO being a bunch of freeloaders. And there's a concern that the next shoe that may drop, Trump may decide that in a week or two, he may announce that we're pulling out of NATO. He's announced that we're pulling out of Syria, and we're going to cut the troops in half in Afghanistan. And frankly, there may be a case can be made, because after 17 years, that seems to be going nowhere. But pulling out of NATO, if that were to happen, and I think there's
a... Well, this would also be against the advice of multiple generals and multiple experts, which makes it increasingly clear that this president has no geopolitical awareness whatsoever throughout the world. And it's becoming increasingly dangerous as to these global alliances and allegiances that he's compromising or terminating.
Well, the point I wanted to make, Patrick, is that as far as I know, he can do it. He is the commander-in-chief. That's what I find scary. And that there's no adults left in the room now that Mattis is gone. So I don't know whether there are any checks and balances on him. But I thank you for joining us. I don't mean to be so depressing, but I wish you a happy new year.
Okay. Thank you. You as well.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Patrick Mundaca, who is a instructor at John Jay School of Criminal Justice at the City University of New York. In 2003, he served in the U.S. Army in Baghdad, Iraq, and he has an op-ed at CNN, "Trump is a fair-weather friend to the troops." This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.